Hello and welcome to another edition of Podcasts from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. My guest today is South Africa's still relatively new Minister of Home Affairs, Leon Schreiber. I think of all the Democratic Alliance MPs drafted into the cabinet after the creation of the Government of National Unity, it'd be fair to say that Dr. Leon Schreiber has the most impressive academic record and also the most impressive delivery record so far in implementing deep and meaningful changes in South African law. Just 2 weeks ago, he gazetted big changes to the visa regime, making it much easier for foreigners who want to keep their jobs but live and work here from South Africa at the same time to actually do that, and introducing a transparent point system for anybody who wants to come and work here. These things have been in the offing for ages while predecessors at Home Affairs did it around. Leon Schreiber got them done, and I suspect he's only just beginning. He has completely eliminated a huge backlog of ID card applications and is almost 70% of the way through a backlog of more than 300,000 visa applications. And his team at Home Affairs are processing around 1,500 applications a day, which is just extraordinary when you think about what's been like in the past. As they make it possible for people to visit the country and spend some of their money here. A quick check at his qualifications are bachelor's, honors, and master's in political science at Stellenbosch and a PhD from the Free University of Berlin before working as a researcher at Princeton University in the US. But what has impressed me the most about Leon Schreiber is his clear application and appreciation of just how central Home Affairs is to the economy. Previous ANC ministers have used the department almost as a barrier to entry into South Africa, and he seems to be turning that on its head, using it to get the right talent into the country, which surely has to be the right thing to do. Minister, I know you're in Geneva today, so thank you very much for joining me. I hope I haven't misrepresented what you are doing at Home Affairs. It can be risky putting job numbers to reforms like the one that you're doing, but just talk to us briefly about your goal at the department. What's the dream there? Can you digitize everything?
Thank you very much, Peter. It's great to be with you, and I think you've done a good job on sort of the initial highlights from the first 100 days. I'll forgive you because I've tried to ban the word new minister internally in the department, but
okay.
It's okay that you're still using it. It doesn't feel new. In fact, it feels like we really are pedal to the metal. So I think you're right that the apex priority that we've defined here is to digitize, really embrace technology and undergo a really profound digital transformation of this department. It is completely doable. In fact, I was recently engaging on what the Kenyans have done, and I would encourage anyone to simply Google e-citizen Kenya. And what you will find there is an extraordinary example of what's possible. You can interact not only with their version of Home Affairs through that platform, you can sell property. Your title deed is instantly transferred on a digital secure platform. Can you just imagine in South Africa's case how much value and time that can save us? So the world is moving in this direction at a rapid rate. And I think the truth is South Africa has been left behind. The fact that we still have these paper-based manual processes means that we are increasingly falling behind what even on the rest of the continent, countries are doing. So when we talk about digital transformation, we've really encapsulated in this idea of Home Affairs at home. The idea that these problems that people have experienced at Home Affairs are related to the model itself. One of those problems are the long queues. They also include the network issues where we are constrained by the State Information Technology Agency. They are obviously issues around corruption. All of these things, when you think about it, relate to the model itself. The model is one that is paper-based, that is manual, that opens up opportunities for corruption at every step of that process. You can't even properly oversee what's happening at Home Affairs at any given moment because it's not digitized. There's no dashboard that enables you to have a view of that. The same goes for the queues. The queues exist because we force people to go somewhere, whereas you are able today to interact with your bank with the revenue service from home? And it was one of the first questions I asked at our strategic planning session with the department. I asked the team, we were about 70 people there, to raise your hands when the last time you visited a bank branch. A few hands went up sort of in the last 6 months. Then I asked, what's the last time you visited SARS? And I think there were two or three hands that went up for a matter of years, actually. And I said, then asked, what's the last time you heard about someone who had to visit Home Affairs? And all the hands went up. So I think that that illustrates nicely the sort of concept that we're pursuing. And to answer your question, it is absolutely doable, but we need to deal with some regulatory hurdles along the way. That's really the big challenge.
And Minister, I mean, one of the, you know, if you look at previous attempts to digitize any department of government, it's often been the sort of locus of the greatest corruption scandals that we've had, you know, with serious amounts of money have gone into some contractor, whether to digitize transport or whatever it might be, and nothing's come of it. How do you do that here so that it's free of those kinds of risks?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, the one big technical term they use is dependency we've got is the State Information Technology Agency, or CETA. And I've been very upfront about the fact that we need to change the way this model works across government, actually, because procurement is managed by them. And so you can go back and look at some of these contracts and how these things would have happened. So that's one of the things that we need to address. And as I say, it's a regulatory challenge, but we are not going to accept it as an excuse. Simply sit back and say, well, CETA says we can't fix it, so good luck standing in the queues for the rest of your life. That's not going to happen. We have to solve it. And that is the challenge that we are grappling with. It's detailed and sensitive work to make sure that you can come up with a legal framework, but we are going to do that. I think the second point then is to, before we even talk about new procurement, look very carefully at contract management inside the department already and make sure that we get rid of duplications, make sure that where people have not delivered, that we're actually able to move away from those kind of issues and actually run new processes where things are actually based on who can do the job and deliver the functions we need. I've been very clear in the department from day one, and it is a consistent message because it's simply the truth, that what we need is fit for purpose, and we have one agenda, and that is to deliver on the digital transformation agenda and actually make Home Affairs work. So everything we do must be judged on that basis. And I think if you can embed that in how you handle even things like contracting that you're talking about, that you can run it better. Because the problem, Peter, is that there were other agendas. It's really that simple. You don't accidentally have a corrupt tender. It's because someone had a particular agenda. And we will have to act like hawks in preventing that from happening. But I think you set the tone by making it clear the agenda is quite simply value for money and delivering what we need. And I think perhaps just briefly to also say we don't always have to procure everything. We are looking at ways in which we can partner both inside and outside government to assist us with some of the things that we need. So, I mean, we've already done it successfully on the visa backlog project. We're working with Business Unity South Africa. They've provided enormously helpful resources on that. We have partnerships with the banks, as you know, in some of these branches. So the principle is there. It can work in a way also that doesn't cost us millions every year.
How does this talk to us briefly about these backlogs. So you've got, you inherited 306,000, I think it was, visa applications. You're plowing your way through them at a previously unheard of rate. How does that actually happen? I mean, do somebody now stand there with a whip like the sort of, you know, driver of a Roman galley, or you're talking about business helping out? Are there physical bodies doing this in Home Affairs? And are they all Home Affairs officials, or are there been people who've been seconded in through Business South Africa, Business Unity South Africa?
So there's a couple of elements to how it's being done, but I think the important point is simply political will, most importantly. And the most important thing from my side is that the leader of this backlog project, who is doing a phenomenal job, has to report to me every single day how many have been done, in which categories, where are the bottlenecks, why are things slow. If there's a particular category that we find, for example, that a lot of people have abandoned their applications, how do we get in touch with them so that we can actually move on from those and not regard them as part of a backlog. For example, if someone's waited 10 years and they've, you know, the application period itself has expired. So I think it starts with just being absolutely clear again, as I said, about what the agenda is. The agenda is to fix the problem, nothing more than that. And then, of course, we've got various tools and resources that we're using, I think, very effectively in the process. There are physical human beings doing this. I mean, I personally visited the auditorium at our headquarter building in Pretoria, where there are, I think, about 60 or 70 people that were then there. But that number has also grown from within Home Affairs, I think, quite promisingly. People are actually volunteering to work overtime and to get involved in this. It's quite a remarkable story. So we've got a deviation from the Minister of Public Service and Administration, for which I'm very grateful, that has enabled us to work more overtime. But here you go, Peter, a government department working more overtime than what the normal provisions would be. So we've got people on Saturdays in the auditorium going through these applications. And then we've got the support from Business Unity, as I mentioned. We have a group of young, legally qualified people from one of the organizations that are actually helping us physically process these applications. But then we've also got a lot of training and, as I say, just, you know, resources in the form of tools that we need, technology, computers, etc., whatever the case may be. And that's been enormously helpful. So, I mean, I think it's a culmination of different factors. But really, at the end of the day, I think we've created not an environment with a whip necessarily, as you mentioned, but one where people, I think, are feeling like the work that they do matters. They're contributing towards a project that is understood to be important. It's part of the messaging that I've been putting out to say that we are an economically important portfolio. We've got other critical functions, but Home Affairs is an economic enabler as well. And I think people are starting to see the potential we have to kickstart job creation and growth. And I would hope that we deliver on our target. I mean, as you say, I think we're probably on 60-70% today as we speak, given the great pace that we've now really hit. And I'd like to be able to say that we've cleared this backlog by Christmas. We've said no backlog by Christmas. That's the slogan. And
that would be absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah.
So in the reforms that you gazetted the other day, you introduced as well a points-based system for getting a visa to come and live and work in South Africa. And it was interesting because previously you would have had to be on the critical skills list or whatever it was called. I think it may even still exist. And the company wanting to employ you would have to prove all sorts of, you know, it was a real minefield. So this seems to be much easier. But so if I ran a biscuit company, I make biscuits in the Eastern Cape somewhere, and I wanted to hire a Vietnamese baker that I met on holiday, right? This guy makes the most fabulous biscuits I've ever tasted. Nobody else has anything like that. Can I now go ahead and hire this guy? Or, you know, do I have to still go out and prove that I've tried my best to find a South African to do the job? And by which time my Vietnamese baker has gone somewhere else.
So let me just respond quickly to the categories question that you asked. So the critical skills visa exists in law as well as a general work visa. Those are two categories within the law. The critical skills list was previously and continues to be used to allocate critical skills visas. If your occupation is there on that list, then the message is that we need you as a scarce skill to help grow the economy. But what has really not been very effective is the general work visa as well, whereby we didn't really have a system that could dictate something, you know, a skill or a set of circumstances that fall outside of the ability of a bureaucrat's pen to determine. And that's the purpose of that visa. It's always been the purpose of the visa, but it has actually in practice been completely stymied by the lack of sensible enabling regulation. So all we've done is essentially comply with what the law always envisioned, which is that there are categories of work visas that fall outside of a centralized list. Now, we've done it by creating the points-based system. I must thank the presidency and Operation Vulindlela. They've been doing a lot of work on this for a long time. And, you know, we've really accelerated that work over the last few months. And what we've gotten out of it is a basic calculator. We've even put the tool up on our website where you have to get 100 points. Now, if you have a critical skill that's on the list, you get your 100 points, and that results in a critical skills visa being issued. If you don't have something on the critical skills list, then you can't qualify for a critical skills visa, but you may still qualify for the general work visa. And then our point system allows you to calculate whether you get to 100 through a combination of experience, qualifications, and then I think, very importantly, the salary level. Because if someone offers you a high salary, they are indicating something about how valuable you are to their enterprise. And then there's a couple of other categories. Do you speak an official language? And do you have an offer from a trusted employer? This one is quite important because we've got the trusted employer scheme that's working quite well to speed up some of these processes. And this adds another incentive for big corporates to become part of that scheme, because you actually get extra points where we say, we recognize you as, you know, a big vehicle manufacturer, for example, in South Africa, and therefore you have that added incentive. So to answer your question about the Vietnamese baker, it will depend on the exact circumstances. It's not like, you know, it's without any adjudication. But if you look at the calculator, if that person has, you know, more than 10 years experience, if they've got a particular qualification that we can evaluate, and they've got a good job offer, then you can bring in your highly skilled Vietnamese baker, which is probably exactly the kind of thing that the critical skills list could not have anticipated your business needs.
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of the system, is that it really gives, you know, that flexibility and respect actually to the market, and the fact that the market changes. You know, we can't sit constantly updating a central list and think we will anticipate everything.
So just move along a little bit. So immigration is one of the big, you know, touchstones, I think, of our time in the world generally at the moment. And I wonder, what your attitude to it is. It's a very hot topic, as we know, in South Africa. What do we think? What do you think of undocumented people coming here to look for work? You should, you know, it takes a lot of courage to migrate, actually, to pick up sticks and leave your country and go somewhere else. It's a big risk. And, you know, should South Africans not hire them? What happens if what's going to happen if you arrive in South Africa and no papers? And quite frankly, you've tried it, you know, you tried Home Affairs in the past and they haven't responded, or, you know, it's Home Affairs becomes part of the problem in a way, or has been part of the problem. What are you going to do? What should we do about undocumented or illegal immigrants in South Africa?
Well, I think the way to start that answer is to make the differentiation. Sorry, and we always have to do that. There's a distinction between facilitating skilled immigration, tourism, as well as investment through the kind of regulatory change that we've effected, and someone who comes into the country illegally. So even just at a conceptual level, the one and the you know, all the evidence, economic evidence shows this. If we attract more skills into our economy, we're going to create more jobs for South Africans. There's just no two ways about it. In fact, the research commissioned by the Reserve Bank and others has shown that 7 new jobs are created for South Africans for every highly skilled person that you bring into the economy. And that's even before we talk about tourism, which is the remote work visa that we've now gazetted is a great win-win deal for South Africa. It's just a way for people to spend foreign currency in South Africa and create jobs. So that's one category of the discussion. And I think we will simply have to follow the economic logic if we want to address growth and unemployment, which is our biggest crisis. Then you have, obviously, as you say, undocumented people. And again, there you have to differentiate. What is the responsibility of the government in creating parts of these problems? And, you know, we sit with a backlog of asylum applications as well, especially on the appeal side. So that is our responsibility. You cannot punish someone when it is the state that has actually failed to process someone who may have submitted an application. So that's, again, another differentiation that you must make. But of course, Peter, where you get into cases where people are willfully or deliberately breaking the law, including through misrepresentation, which is a real problem, then we must restore the rule of law to that process. But those things are actually all interdependent. because you can't properly prosecute someone or ensure that you have rule of law if your own system cannot differentiate between someone who's willfully breaking the law and someone who's just been failed by the system. And then we go back to why technology is so key, because we need to have biometrics for people. We need to be able to know who's in the country. We need to be able to track their applications. I cannot emphasize, it's so seemingly boring, but if you don't have a view on where someone's application is in the process and what the bottleneck is causing the problem, then you actually cannot enforce the law. So we have to clean our house if we want to deal with those bona fide cases where there should be legal consequences. And I suppose the last thing I would say is we will do all of that. And we are doing it. We're ramping up, you know, our cooperation with the Department of Employment and Labor where there are bona fide cases that need to be answered. But we will not do it in a way that promotes xenophobia. I've been absolutely clear about that. And that's why I'm talking about differentiating between the specific circumstances of different people. And I think South Africa, of all countries on earth, should know the danger of inflaming tension and hatred against a whole group of people, sometimes for political reasons. So we will not engage in that.
You had a big thing a couple of weeks ago where people were, restaurants and were being raided by the Department of Employment, I think it was, by inspectors. People were being arrested. I think, I'm not sure who was being arrested, whether it was the workers or the owners. And it made me very uncomfortable because one didn't know why some of these people might not have had their documentation. But the other thing I wanted to ask you was, what happens to somebody who gets arrested in South Africa for not having their papers? You know, it all sounds very Germany, late 1930s, but are we able to treat these people humanely, or do they get shoved into a detention center while they wait for something to happen? How well are we behaving?
Well, Peter, let me just say your comparison there is exactly what will not be fueled by the Department of Home Affairs as long as I'm there. That is just absolutely not something that we will accept. And so that's why I'm emphasizing this point that we all have a responsibility to differentiate between criminality and the rule of law on the one hand and blatant xenophobia and incitement on the other. And we will not tolerate the second. But to answer your question again, obviously there's huge work to do to make the system work better. But in principle, South Africa has one of the better approaches because someone who's arrested must appear before a magistrate. They must do so within a short time, and the magistrate must confirm a deportation order. Of course, there are bottlenecks in that process. You can only imagine, because then you get into the justice system and the inefficiencies there. Also, some of the facilities that are used where people are held before they are deported or before these orders are executed, we must make that something that complies with the humane spirit that we want to treat everyone with. But in doing so, this is the point, we are not actually undermining our ability to enforce the law. We're enhancing our ability to enforce the law. If the courts work better, if Home Affairs works better, we're going to be able to have a much stronger system to do the kind of differentiation that I'm talking about. So South Africa, in principle, can be a place that manages these things without going down the route of, incitement or hatred. But of course, we have so much work to do to actually make sure that what exists on paper, as in so many cases, is what's happening on the ground.
Let's turn to government as a whole for the moment and your experience of it. We'll agree that you're not new, but you've certainly had enough time to form some opinions. You famously were the man behind the case that eventually forced the ANC to surrender its deployment committee minutes to the DA or to make them public. What's it like now to sit with them and make policy with them? And how would you rate the quality of conversation in cabinet? I mean, are you enjoying the experience? Are you pleasantly surprised? Or are things worse than you thought they'd be?
I think, firstly, let me just point out that the case you're referring to continues. And I think it's actually an important element of the answer to your question because they did not surrender fully the records that we needed. And so we instituted contempt proceedings. We won the case in the High Court. And recently, um, their the application for leave to appeal was dismissed. And so we're pressing ahead with that because...
When do you expect to see more documentation?
Depends on how far they can draw out the Stalingrad tactics.
But
the truth is, what they did not become legal just because a coalition government was formed. So we are going to persist with that until we have all the answers that we need. And I think that links then to your broader question. It's a balancing act where we need to make sure that we find each other where we can find consensus and agreement. And, those things are important because they build trust across parties, and there's no need to be senseless in some of these things when people can see the direction that we need to take on electricity, for example, and then in principle agreement on many other issues, including Transnet, the other big economic elephant in the room, where the reforms just don't seem to be implemented properly, but where the principle agreement does exist. So I think those are instances where bridges can be built. And I think that from the DA side, we are approaching it with an open and fair mind when we find those instances. But then there are cases where we will disagree and in many cases have to disagree. And, it's about making sure that you actually identify those moments correctly and then hold the line when you confront them.
Not only do you have cabinet meetings where you are talking to your colleagues, but you have these sort of cluster committee meetings, right? I'm not sure what cluster Home Affairs is in. You should be in the economic, in finance, but I doubt that you are.
We're in the security cluster and in something about governance and institutional development, but that doesn't preclude us from playing an economic role, let me put it that way.
Yeah. So, and what are those conversations? Is it a different kind of conversation in the cluster to what it might be in cabinet?
Yes, it is. It's a little bit more in depth because a lot of reports need to pass through that before it ends up in the full cabinet. I think probably in general, there are some more interesting discussions that take place there. But also, Peter, the other thing is a lot of this is sort of routine reporting and compliance as well. That's also part of what gets discussed here. So you'll find often that, processes need to move and you're not going to have an issue about everything that's moving through cabinet. I think what's going to be critically important is the discussions on the medium-term development plan that we're now busy finalizing, as well as on the budget that's coming up, the medium-term budget policy statement. So those will be two sort of big markers, again, in this process. And I think maybe the overarching point is people shouldn't be under the impression that the government was negotiated and then it started governing. The negotiations continue on some of these sort of bigger issues. But where we find each other, where we are in agreement, for example, on the visa reforms, there we must go ahead and simply implement as fast and effectively as we can. And I think
was there any resistance to that in your cluster or in the cabinet?
I mean, the irony about these reforms, Peter, is that all those discussions would have even happened long before the GNU was formed, because this was the outcome, actually, of the work that I mentioned earlier that Vulindlela Lela and others had been doing. So in principle, there was already an agreement that South Africa's economy has a desperate shortage of skills. It's falling way short on tourism and that something needs to be done. And so I simply went through with a magnifying glass, the regulations and the rules and the requirements and the red tape, and was able to implement that. So this is my point. Where we're in agreement, for goodness sake, don't stand around consulting and talking for another 3 years. Just go and implement the mandate where we agree on things. Because, where we disagree is where a lot of the media coverage will go and where things can get bogged down, etc. So that makes it even more important that we're actually taking action on the things that we do agree about.
Yeah. And what's your opinion of President Cyril Ramaphosa's style? Does he speak frankly and openly in meetings, or is he a hard taskmaster, or is he reluctant to interfere? What sort of a leader is he?
I think he's interested in hearing about what is happening inside these departments. So I certainly don't feel like we don't have a platform to go and talk about what we found. And as you know, for anyone who served on a board or a formal structure, it's often also the more informal conversations where, you know, you get a sense of things before you go into the formal forum. And so, you know, I think that, again, it's not only about the president. It's the cross-party nature of this government too, where, you know, John Steenhuisen can talk to other party leaders as well to suss out their views on things informally. And I think that that is developing. The one thing I would add, though, is that we really urgently need that technical committee or clearinghouse or whatever we're going to end up calling it, because...
Has that not happened yet?
Well, there are discussions. There's in-principle agreement, but I would like the meeting of this thing to actually happen. The first sort of issues need to be sent there, because I suppose you could look at it as an intermediate step between an informal conversation and the formal cabinet process. And those are really important in the multi-party government, because, you know, you don't...
It's going to be very important in terms of things like the Bella Bill, for instance, on language in schools, and that's got to be done. You're running out of time already. It was 3 months, and now it's 2 months. Yeah. My impression of Cyril, or the president, was always that he would tend to allow ministers to do pretty much what they want. And is that accurate? I mean, is it... People seem to go off on their own, you know. Ministers that didn't seem to talk to each other, departments didn't seem to talk to each other. First of all, is he relaxed about what you do, or does he have a controlling streak? Or is there a case for more cooperation between departments?
Yes, I think there definitely is. I don't know exactly what the answer to the question is on sort of how he regards all of this. I think probably the differentiator so far has been in cases where we have cultivated agreement, and in some cases agreement that predates the formation of the government, that can be a good thing, because then you're able to move without, you know, sort of feeling like you don't have space or you're constrained. But on the other hand, I think, you know, the coordination between departments is crucially important. I suppose to a large extent, that's what the presidency tries to do through the effectively a delivery unit that it has set up through the presidency. And I mean, I've said to the president that I think this is one of the better moves that he's made. I really credit him with finding sort of an ability to unlock that kind of coordination. I do think we need more of it. And, you know, let me be very frank in answering the other part about, you know, what can you do in a portfolio? The public needs to judge. The public needs to judge the individuals in these portfolios. They need to judge me and all of my colleagues and arrive at a conclusion as to whether we've, you know, made use of the opportunity that we've been given. And from my perspective, let me tell you one thing, Pete. I don't know how this all ends, but I certainly don't have 30 years. I certainly don't have, you know, a perception that I'm going to be here until Jesus returns, as Zuma famously or infamously said. And so I need to do as much as possible, as quickly as possible, as effectively as possible, while we've got an opportunity to make a difference. That's my approach. And frankly, where there are obvious, clear pathways to make South Africa better, that no one is going to stand in the way there. That's where we will fight to make sure we deliver those things. And I think that needs to be the approach of this government.
Yeah. So you're a student of government. I mean, you really are a student of government. I mean, the team around you seem to have done incredible things in your first 100 days. Are they, I've asked this question in another form before, but are they better than you expected them to be?
It's really hard to say what your expectations were exactly if you come out of the opposition benches directly. I think that the capacity problems are worse than I would have expected. And that goes with, you know, shortage of staff. Home Affairs has 40% of the officials we actually need to make the existing model work, which, by the way, is another reason why we must change the model. You don't go and try and fix the hamster wheel, you get off it. And, you know, I think there has been a clear denuding of skills in the public sector across the board. But what I think has been interesting and in my case, I think has been a real part of the progress we've made is the attitude that the senior leadership has demonstrated. I think, frankly, it comes also from the relationship that I've built and certainly been reciprocated with the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs and the way we've engaged staff. I mean, it's very important when you walk into a new environment to actually engage people in a respectful manner and to be very clear about what it is that you want to achieve here. Because what I did find and what I think is positive is there are people in Home Affairs that have had ideas, that have seen problems for many years and have thought about solutions, but I don't think have felt until now that there was someone who was genuinely interested in the detail. I mean, I think it's quite surprising to some of them how obsessive I was about, you know, checking some of these regulations, you know, finding out about how offices work and how we can reform things. And then I think also feeling like they've got a safe environment where someone doesn't get persecuted just because they, you know, raise an idea or put something on the table. And I think the atmosphere is a very important ingredient of why we've made progress in 100 days. It doesn't mean it's always going to be smooth sailing. But just to give you a metaphor, I think, where the Director General of Home Affairs deserves real credit, is after the President made the announcement around 10 p.m. Of the Cabinet, the DG had phoned me before 11 p.m. to introduce himself, to welcome me. And the next morning, and you see this is where the reciprocation comes in, the next morning at 7, I was on a flight to go and meet him and the whole senior management team. So from both sides, we did not waste time in sort of signaling that this is a transition that must work and that we will treat each other, I think, with respect as we map the changes that are required.
But that's an incredibly encouraging story in a way. I mean, the what you want in the country, surely, is somewhere like probably like France, where the state becomes a really, you know, becomes things that you have ambitions to join. Is it possible, and I don't mean to start a political fight here, but is it possible for this government to turn the state into an object of desire, you know, where the best and the brightest are attracted, because not only because the pay is good, but because the jobs are challenging and interesting, and the work is compelling.
It is possible, Peter, and it links really to, you know, the work I did from opposition, and what I've always been interested in is this nexus between human resources, essentially HR processes, and reform, and how you actually make real reform happen, how you build the capacity that you need, basically through HR. And I think if I look at Home Affairs right now, and we'll have an interesting test in our case coming up very shortly, because we've got three very senior vacancies, Deputy Director General positions, including the one for IT. Now, you can imagine, in terms of the vision that I've described, how important that position is going to be, as well as for Human Resources and Immigration Services. And so I think the caliber of people who apply will give a signal as to whether people may already be looking at least at Home Affairs. I can't speak for everyone, but at least looking at Home Affairs and saying, and I hope this would be the case, that, you know, making a contribution to South Africa that results in us, you know, fixing our identity and immigration systems and unlocking the growth that goes with that and enhancing security and really modernizing government services would be a compelling reason for someone to apply, for skilled people to come forward and apply. And I think really, objectively, there has been no better time to get involved, because there is there's an opening for reform. It depends on how seriously you're going to drive it through and actually just do the work rather than, as I say, sit around for the next 5 years and talk about it. So that'll be an interesting test. But in principle, it definitely is doable. And let me tell you what, if you get your ID delivered to your house at some point, Peter, then I think it's only would have been because we would have gotten some of the right people on board to help us execute this vision. So the proof is really in the pudding.
Is an independent silver surface, is that a pipe dream, or is that a real possibility here, Eva?
Well, you know, one of the good things was by the time that I left my, you know, the opposition role on the public service and administration portfolio, the pressure that we had piled on over the cadre deployment issue had actually resulted in some meaningful policy change. So the professionalization framework that came out in 2022 was the first signal, I think. And then there are some bills that are before the committee that would actually begin to really separate politics from the administration, including the Public Service Amendment Bill. I don't exactly know where they are in the process, but the fact that we've gotten to a bill, it's really about the legal and regulatory environment so that, you know, the public servants can actually have the space to implement, but be held very strictly accountable if they move away on policy. And you know, it must be achievable because it happens in so many places around the world.
Yeah. Final question, Millicent. Thank you so much for your time. The GNU, is that going to survive? Has it got legs?
It's got legs, but, you know, the legs can be cut out from under any situation at any time. I think there are going to be some big moments that we can see coming, and then there are possibly the unknown unknowns, as they say. I think some of the known unknowns would be, you know, internal changes in some of the parties. There are elective congresses coming up, not only for the ANC, but actually for many parties that are involved in this. So that would
including
be one of the markers.
Including, at some stage, the DA, I presume.
Including the DA as well, yes. So, you know, it's a marker to watch whether the parties are able to actually build continuity, even as you have, you know, some of these elections taking place. Then I think the 2026 local government election will probably be the next big marker. So I think, Peter, probably after Congress season, after the local government election, that would be an important moment to reflect again. If it's still got legs then I think it would be a really strong outcome and signal that you know, it could go the distance. I think those are around that period, 26, 27 is going to be a big test.
So we've got two years to sort of wait and look and see, biting our nails, living on our nerves. But
from my perspective, we might have less than that, and we just have to get as much as humanly possible done.
Okay. Minister Leon Schreiber, thank you so much for making time during your meetings today in Geneva. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure listeners will as well. And to those listeners, thank you very much for joining me. I'll be back soon. Meanwhile, bye-bye. Take care.